Coming off of his first murder trial and a win, Agent Rob Santoro's next case looked like a ground ball and a rarity, a case with three eyewitnesses who were all cooperative. But the Christmas Eve killing of Michael Polite at the home where his children lived with their mother was anything but simple once it got to court. Join us as we discuss how a witness's surprise admission from the stand, coupled with national political upheaval, led to the first of what turned out to be several mistrials, and taught Agent Santoro and the prosecutors valuable lessons on why we never stop. We're welcoming y'all back to Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, and I have back my most popular guest, and that is Rob Santoro, and I don't mean just popular with me. No, seriously, man, you're getting more listens than anybody else, so you're actually really special.
Oh, well, that makes me feel good. Thanks, Christy.
Yeah, no, anytime. And in fact, I need to check the overall numbers, but some of your episodes, particularly the one on Darren Manigo, has been extremely popular. A lot of people are listening to it, and so the word's getting out, and that's pretty awesome.
Hopefully people get something out of it, you know. Hopefully it's people can listen to what we talk about and get something out of it, hopefully.
Well, right. And so we wanted to talk because I know that we have mentioned in previous episodes that there are some cases that we hadn't had a chance to really talk about. And those involved another prosecutor who recently left the Chatham County District Attorney's Office, Jenny Parker. And now she's willing to talk on the podcast. I'm really excited.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping to have her over so we can do like all three of us on a Zoom together. And do it that way, because I now have like, I have like fancy space. You haven't been able to see it, but I've got like chairs and, you know.
Very like, nice.
Yeah, I've painted and redecorated in the whole nine yards, so we can just hang out and get caught up and talk about this case. And so among the cases we wanted to talk about is this case of State of Georgia versus Maurice Bentley. And this case kind of like falls right after, unless I'm mistaken, right after what, the trial of Sean Chaley? Is it right in there?
Yeah, it was like, I think the same week, actually, I think. Yeah,
that's the way I remember it. And that is another case we absolutely have to talk about and talk about with Jenny. And that was a very, very complicated investigation. It's got that kind of sprawl that I like. And this case wouldn't have seemed to have had that on the surface. So I want to talk about this. So you come out of trial, and I remember the trial of Sean Chaley vividly. Do you remember this, like being up past midnight waiting on a jury?
Of course I do. How could I ever forget? It was my first jury trial.
You were just still eating like sugar cookie pop tarts.
I still do that. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I actually love them. They're super tasty. I just don't get them that often. You come off of that and you're back on duty immediately.
Yeah, I want to say, I'm trying to pull this calendar up, but so this case actually happened Christmas Eve night. So we had, if I remember it right, the Deloach trial, I want to say started like the 19th or the 20th?
That sounds right. And that sounds right.
It was like the week of Christmas. And I remember everybody was like, we're never doing like starting a trial like the week of Christmas ever again, or something like that. But so yeah, like this is the way it seemed to always happen for me, though. It was like not even out of one before the next one comes. And I guess, yeah, that was the theme like that we've talked about already. And in this and unit and on this podcast about this unit, just like the volume and just the work. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that, okay, so here we go. I want to say the the Loach trial started on the 16th, which was a Monday. We got a verdict on the 20th. So then the 24th, I'm catching my next murder, and that's Christmas Eve night. So, a really, really tragic time to have a homicide altogether. And,
I will say I think that we could do, you know, like a whole show or multiple shows on Christmas homicides or, you know, holiday related. St. Patrick's Day just passed. You know, I've had a bunch of homicides that come around holiday time or summer. It's just, you know, it seems to be when tensions run the most high. And that's
it seemed to be that way, especially, you know, like you said, it's like every holiday, and our families can attest to that. It's just like, you can't really count on being home. If you get that, it's a luxury in this line of work. So, this one was like 9:30 at night was when we got the call, and it was a homicide over in Carver Heights or Carver Village.
And this particular part of Savannah, Carver Heights, Carver Village, and particularly at that time, and I don't think it's changed that much, was not like a nice suburban neighborhood.
No, I mean, that the neighborhood had its problems at that time, and I think probably still does. I won't say it's like the worst, probably, but it's not definitely not the best either.
So you get called out at 9 at night on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, at that time, I think it was me and Alan Sammons, of course. Can't have a murder without Alan. And,
oh, and, God, that's awesome.
And Bryony Harris was also with us on this one. This was, she came to our unit the previous September, so she was in her third or fourth month by then.
Yeah, I was gonna say, so, this is still pretty early for her.
Yeah, she was a young homicide detective at that time, and I guess kind of so was I. I guess I had a year and a half by then, something like that. But we had a good group, the three of us. I don't remember if Pew was there or not, but I do know the three of us were working that night. I want to say it was just the three of us on nights that evening. But yeah, this was a chaotic scene when we got there. It was on Elliott Avenue, and we got there pretty quick because I don't remember if I was already in the car or what, but I remember being close, and I remember Alan and I both got to the scene relatively quickly, and patrol was still on scene, just kind of trying to get things under control, getting the scene established, and Michael Polite, who was the victim in this case, was in one of the ambulances. Angela Johnson, who was the surviving victim, was also in an ambulance. They hadn't left the scene yet. They were getting ready to. So eventually they left in the ambulances. And I think Aaron Washington was the precinct one sergeant at the time. And it was just like, it was chaos.
Well, this is at a house. So this is a house at Christmas time. There are, how many people were still there? There was a bunch of family still there, right?
Yeah. So you had, try to give the layout of the relationships here. So Michael Polite, he's the victim. Angela Johnson was there. She was the surviving victim I just talked about. And Angela was Crystal Frazier's mom. So Crystal Frazier is kind of going to be like one of the center players in this incident, and she was the mother of Michael Polite's children. They had four kids together. All the kids were there at the house, and then Kimberly Frazier, which was Crystal's sister, and another one of Angela's daughters was also there. A guy named Charles Grant was there. He was a neighbor who lived a few houses down, and then there were some other people out. But so there was all this kind of going on, and you know, just Crystal ended up herself being transported to the hospital because she had bad asthma and she was having like a panic attack. So like three people from the scene ended up getting transported by ambulance to the hospital. And then, yeah, we were trying to just kind of figure out the scene and secure it. And we did that, but it was, it always takes time, and it always is an effort to get there, right? So it was, I remember it being particularly chaotic, and it was not Theron Robbins chaotic, but it was pretty hectic.
Well, Theron Robbins had, you know, the fighting in the street element that is not, it's part of some cases definitely in Savannah, but it's not the norm, I would guess. But this case, and you know, having met with family and all of those things, because I got into it very, very late, as seems to be my thing. There was a lot of emotion that led up to this too. And so what were you able to figure out right there at the scene that night?
So one of the things that I think Kimberly was one of the people that called 911, and she right away gave the name, I want to say, of Marquise Bentley as the shooter. So right away, Kimberly is giving a description with a name and a vehicle, some kind of dark SUV. So that information came in through the 911 call. Cause what ends up happening is we find out that, the suspect is going to be Crystal Fraser's new boyfriend. So Michael Polite is the father of her kids. And who ends up, we find out, once we make a true identification or positive identification of the name and the person, it's going to be Maurice Bentley. So they gave the name of Marquise initially, but it's because they didn't really know him that well. His real name is actually Maurice. So we were able to figure most of that out pretty quickly. One of the first things that we did, because Crystal and Angela both went to the hospital, Alan and I prioritized the interview with Kimberly, because she was an eyewitness. So we got her out of there. We got Charles Grant out of there to the headquarters, separated them. We each took one of them, but we prioritized the interview with Kim. And Kim gave us a pretty good rundown sort of at least what happened for the shooting. And then we were able to follow up. Bryony Harris followed up with Angela Jones at the hospital. She was able to give a statement there, although in pain. And then eventually Crystal was released from the hospital, and she agreed to come to headquarters, and we talked to her there. So we talked to all three of those women, and Mr. Grant. We talked to all three of them, the women and Mr. Grant, that night within, you know, the first few hours of the investigation.
And right off the bat, are they pretty much consistent in what they're telling you?
Yeah. So do you want the story, or do you want the kind of how we got to the ID? I guess it's kind of all one.
I mean, I think that might be the best way to do it. So what was it that you were able to figure out as far as what the logistics of what had happened?
So Michael Polite arrived over to the house on Elliott Avenue, which was where Crystal was living with Angela and Kim. And he had been there earlier with Kim. I think they went to get food for Christmas Eve. And Crystal was out during the day with Maurice, who went by Bam. So he had a street name of Bam. And so she ended up arriving.
That's a good street name. I got to tell you, Bam's a good street name.
Yeah, I guess. One of my favorites was smoked meat. That was one of my favorites, smoked meat. And food stamp. That's another good one. Food stamp was a good one. And then there was shampoo. Shampoo was another good one. Yeah, I love street names, man.
Street names are the best. Smurf was good. God, yeah. Alan would have to correct me. Who was it that killed Smurf? I've forgotten.
Fly Monkey.
There we go. I think that might be one of the best of all time. Fly Monkey might be my favorite.
Yeah, that's a pretty decent one.
That is pretty good.
Yeah. So anyway, Bam is the new boyfriend. And Crystal comes home that evening with Bam. So Bam's in the car. Crystal goes inside. And Mike had brought a bunch of Christmas presents with him in his truck that night for the kids for Christmas. And Mike just kind of had told Crystal, hey, like, are you going back out or you staying in? Like, I would like for you to stay here with us as a family and have Christmas like we always do together, with the kids as a family. And Crystal was kind of like, well, you know, I'm an independent woman and I spend enough time with the kids basically. And if I want to go out, I'm going to go out. Although she kind of hedged a little bit about her intent to actually go out or not. And so her and Mike get into a little bit of an argument about like, hey, what, like stay home, right? It's Christmas, stay home with the family.
I want to add something here too. So Crystal is not like a really older person. And she has four kids, but she was what, 20 what years old?
I want to say she was like 20 or 21.
Right.
I mean, something like that. She was young. Yeah.
The children are very young. And Michael Polite was actually at that time, I thought, living in Richmond Hill or something.
Yeah.
Like he had to come from Bryan County. So this was like a trip for him to spend time with the family.
Yeah. And, he had Mike had a good relationship with, you know, Angela and Kim and all the kids and stuff. He was a very present father, in his kids' lives and all that. And, so they get into this argument about whether or not Crystal's going to go out or not. And Mike is basically like, why is this guy still parked out front? And she's like, well, cause maybe I'm going out. And he's like, no, you're going to stay in with us as a family. And I'm going to tell him that he's got to leave. So Mike made it up in his mind that he was going to go tell Maurice that he had to leave. And, so when he goes and does that, Maurice is basically like, well, you're not my girlfriend. If she wants me to leave, I gotta hear that from her. And he's basically like, no, you don't, dude. Like you need to leave. And at that point, Maurice pulls a gun out, puts it kind of like on his lap. The way it was described is kind of on his lap. And Mike was like, oh, are you going to shoot me? And so then depending on which one of them you ask, there's maybe a swing or a lunge or something like that from Mike towards Maurice, who's sitting now he's in the front passenger seat of his SUV parked on the side of the street. And Mike's in the front passenger door. So they're right next to each other. And supposedly there's this kind of either swing maybe or not. I think if I remember right, Angela and Kim, neither one of them really described that. I think Crystal was the only one that really kind of said Mike did that. But either way, the next thing that happens is the shots, right? So Maurice shoots Mike. Mike retreats away from the car and runs away from the car towards the backyard where he collapses to the ground. And Maurice continues to shoot Michael in the back and when he's on the ground. And that was consistent from all of them, that he continued to shoot him as he ran away. And then even when he was on the ground, and that was confirmed or found to be consistent with what the ME found. Dr. Downs did the autopsy. And then Maurice gets in the car and hauls ass. Somewhere in that, Angela also caught around. So Angela gets shot in the leg. So she's also shot at this point. And then this was like the mass chaos. At some point during the sort of interaction at that front door, Angela and Kim were trying to break it up and kind of pull Mike back and say, Mike, don't like leave it alone, especially when the gun came out. We never were able to say for sure when Angela got shot, if it was one of the first shots or if it was one of them that hit Mike and then went through or what, but so that's kind of the gist of what went down.
Yeah, and I remember, because Crystal, of course, was a key witness, particularly from the defense perspective in the trial to follow, because of that, she was the only one who said that Mike actually did anything physical that was aggressive.
Right. the caliber of gun that was used from the projectiles that we got out of Mike's body and from the casings that were on scene was .380. And during the investigation, we had learned that at some point in time, Crystal Frazier had purchased a .380 Davis, which was a different brand of .380. The rifling patterns were different between the Davis, which is what Crystal had, and then what ended up being the Breiko Jennings, which was the possible make or the make of what we were looking for.
I'm still hoping that I can get Kevin Rittman to come on the show. So, you know, I'm holding out hope because there was a lot of really fascinating ballistics testimony in this case, or cases, as it turns out. And that is an area of expertise that is unusual. You know, we've had obviously Michelle Shira on, she's talked about fingerprints and things like that. That a lot of people are familiar with. I've had Dr. Downs, and I really want to get him back. But people don't know that much about ballistics, and they assume a lot. I mean, I'm watching this TV show on HBO where some guy's like shooting bullets into a phone book and pulling them out and eyeballing them, like he can tell which one's which. It's like, that's not how that works.
Right.
But again, you know, people think that that's like actual science, so you know it's really not the same sort of thing at all.
That field in particularly, ballistics, has come under a lot of attack and scrutiny lately from the defense, and you know they're making thoughts on it, but they're actually making headway with juries and stuff like that, and you can say what you want, but you know, when you have the ballistic examination and conclusions, and then you also have like people admitting, yeah, like this is the gun I shot it with, and you can confirm it through confessions or, you know, whatever else you can confirm it with, right? Like the actual weapon. It's kind of hard for me to buy into some of that anyway. I mean, I think we should always be keep an open mind and skeptical of things, but certain things are like, I don't know.
I am with you on that. And I do think that there is an interesting dichotomy between, you know, attacks on science and attacks on non-science. Like, you know, the whole world is like, oh, let's question everything. You know, like, but that's a whole discussion that could go on. So this case, though, getting back to this case, because you had a lot going on right then. You've got like a guy who has shot somebody, and Michael didn't die right at the scene, did he?
No, they transported him. They transported him, and they got there pretty quick. But he died at the hospital, and I think he was pronounced sometime around like 10:15 at night. A little later than 10:15, so within 45 minutes pretty much of when the call came in.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about like where he was shot and stuff like that, because I think that was very important at the trial. But you know, again, from a corroboration standpoint, but when you're dealing with this, you've got this killer like out running around somewhere, and you don't have a ton of lead on where he is right away.
Yeah, so the first thing, like what we had to do was really get a good ID, right? So we got the name Marquise Bentley, and of course when we searched that name up, we didn't come up with any real person, so we were like, all right, like maybe it's an alias, or maybe the first name or the last name is a little bit off, whatever. But then when we got Bam, we got the street name of Bam, we could search by alias, and we searched multiple local databases with the street name. And fortunately for us, he'd been documented by officers prior to us with that street name, both in our in-house Savannah police database and then also the sheriff's office. So we had two separate databases kind of confirming the name of Maurice Bentley, and that was very similar to Marquise. So we were like, well, let's throw this dude in a lineup with Kim and see if we're dealing with this is the right guy. And so that's what we did. And you know, pretty immediately she identified him and said, yeah, that's him. That's Bam, who she knew as Bam or Marquise Bentley. And then the next steps after that, you know, cause we interviewed Crystal, we interviewed Angela, got like the basic gist of their observations and what happened. We threw lineups in front of each one of them as well. And both of them also picked him out. So we had three eyewitness identifications of the shooter that night. Within, I want to say, the first 2 to 3 hours, we had three eyewitness IDs, which, you know, I've talked about this before. It's like, you know, like, that's almost like unheard of, you know, like right. most cases you're lucky to get one eyewitness, right? Like,
and, well, right. And especially in a neighborhood like that, you're going to have like, somebody's going to be backing up on it. But I think, you know, that speaks to the love they had for Michael, right?
Of course. Yeah. And, you know, really like that's the other thing. They were all willing cooperators, right? Like Kim was like, yes, like whatever you need. Angela was like, yes, whatever you need. And Crystal hedged a little bit because she had feelings for Maurice or whatever, but you know, even when push came to shove, like she, you know, she told it and she didn't fight anybody on it. Like she was like, yeah, I'll talk to you. And
well, there's also an element of like guilt too. Like she's got to feel a tiny bit responsible, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not just, you know, feelings for Maurice. There's also that feeling of, oh my God, I caused this. And I think Crystal, and she was very, very young, even when I met her, and just, she seemed to be somebody who had very emotional or self-protective, I guess, reactions to things. So yeah, she was a very interesting part of this case. And I think that, you know, I don't know that any of this experience made any of her life easier. But yeah, I mean, they all ID'd, but Crystal, and I want to make this clear too, she'd only been dating Maurice for like, I have in my head, like something like between 2 days and 2 weeks. I mean,
it was a couple of weeks. Yeah. It was like two, maybe 3 weeks before that. It wasn't like a real serious, like long-term type deal. It was very recent.
Yeah. Yeah. So the loyalty she would be feeling to him doesn't seem like consistent with, like, you know, someone you've got four kids with. Like that, something's gonna win here, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, you know, it was, the other thing is, you know, they gave us consent to search their house. Cause the other thing, just real quick before I move on to that, was you know, I talked about Charles Grant, but I mean, he ended up being a very, very important witness because, you know, Kim, Crystal, and Angela, they're all family, right? So like you could say, oh, they're all in cahoots or whatever, but Charles Grant lived down the street. He knew him and he was friends with him, like friendly with him, neighborly, but he wasn't close enough to see because it was dark out, but he could see like silhouettes and he was outside and he saw enough of what happened to say that like the shooter did not remain on scene. The shooter went around to the front of the car, left in the car, and he described the car. And that was that ended up being a big thing because as we get into the trial or trials of this case, that was one of the things that was argued, was that Crystal was a potential shooter or Crystal was the shooter. And so he ended up being a really big piece of defending against that for us. And what he saw, even though he wasn't able to make an ID because he was too far away and it was at night. So there was that, but you know, then Crystal and Angela and Kim, they gave consent to search their cars. And it was one of those kind of sad cases to work at the scene where, you know, you've got Mike's truck that you're looking in to make sure there's no weapons. And of course there wasn't, but it was like, he had the kids' Christmas presents in the back and it was just like, damn, dude, you know? And it just kind of resonates for me for his kids, because his kids were all there.
Right.
I was told they weren't outside when it happened, but I have my suspicions that they may have seen more than what was told to us. And who knows how that's forever changed them and their just total experience for holidays and Christmas. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how those kids process that, you know? How do you make that okay? How do you make Christmas something that you ever celebrate?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, or, you know, any of that family, Crystal, Kim, Angela, that's, you know, and of course Mike's parents and all of that. It's just awful. So yeah, that whole aspect of it. And you talked about, you know, right there at the time, there was a 911 call. You talked about Kim calling 911. You know, was there time for them to be like hiding stuff and getting rid of guns and all of those kinds of things in this case?
No, I mean, I know for like the last trial, we actually had to like down to the minutes and seconds of like how long that was. It was like 6 minutes and 30 something seconds, if I remember right. It was like less than 7 minutes for sure. And she's on the phone the whole time and they're just freaking out, right? Like it's chaos and crisis. It's not, oh, Crystal, why'd you do that? Let's hide the gun. Let's, you know, let's conceal this. And it, like, there was no time and there was no, like, there was so too much emotion for none of them were thinking logically. Like I can tell you that because they were even like that when we got there. So it was, it just wasn't really a rational defense, but it's one of those things that, you know, as we talk about juries and evidence and what's believed and what's not believed. And, you know, everybody brings their own experiences to the table. And it's why we have juries, but, you know, a case like this, it just kind of gives you a new understanding of, you don't, I don't know. You just never know what people are going to think. You never know what they're going to believe. And this case was a lesson for me in that, like, you know, because walking into this case, right, like 6 hours later, I'm getting an arrest warrant for murder on Maurice Bentley, which, yeah, that's quick, but like way over the bar of probable cause, right? You three eyewitnesses, they all, you know, no real aspects of self-defense here. It's just straight up a murder. And, right. You know, I'm feeling pretty good. Like, yeah, man, I got a good case here, right? Like I got, you know, it's probably going to get better, right, as I continue to work, but like I got a pretty good case, right?
Well, right. I mean, so you have like this initial like, oh my god, I've got ideas and stuff, which is extremely rare, but all of the big work that we've talked about in some of these other cases, all of the, you know, pouring through Facebook and pouring through cell phones and all that stuff, you had still to do in this case.
Correct.
But
yeah.
You have, like, you've gotten over the big hurdle and, you know, the rest of it's almost like gravy, right? Or that's what you're thinking.
Yeah. And you figure like, you know, it's like downhill running, but, you know, like, again, this case just taught me, and it's good that I had this one early on in my career because it's like, you know, no case is ever good enough. No matter how good you think it is, it can never be too good. And you can never take it for granted. And especially that stuff in trial. Like, I mean, you know, it's like, oh, well, do you really think you're going to have to time down to how long it was between the call and when police got there down to the minute for the jury trial? Like, I would kind of say you wouldn't have to do that, but I've learned that like that's the detail that a jury expects. And that's the detail that a jury needs. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? Like we talked about that. I think I said that in the Manigo episode that like, you know, murder convictions should be difficult to come by, but, there's also aspects of reasonableness and, you know, this kind of like TV or platinum standard of evidence that people have come to expect is sometimes not always reasonable. And I wrote a little bit about that in on this case. And just in my writings, we talked about how I write and I've written about this one a little bit. I don't know that I'm going to share it on this episode, but, it's just, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it's,
what you're saying is exactly why the jury charge is beyond a reasonable doubt, not beyond a shadow of a doubt, right? Reasonable has a very specific meaning and it's not just a legal meaning. You know, it is, we're talking about logic. We're not talking about fantasy. We're not talking about perfection because it's a human endeavor, right? We're not going to get that. But I do think that your experience is something that can be a lesson to a whole lot of other investigators because you know, it's the kind of thing you run into, especially with young investigators and people who think, I don't need to do all that, right? And you've heard people say that. You've heard people, you know, like, I'm too tired, I can't get all that done, those kinds of things.
Well, and prosecutors too, right? I mean, I don't need to introduce this evidence, you know, it's,
yeah. we don't want to get into the weeds,
you know, like we just,
oh, my yeah. favorite is we're yeah. not going to admit this, you know, 404B or whatever similar transaction. Oh no, you don't need that. It's like, I don't know what I need.
Yeah.
I don't know what I need because I don't know what's in those jurors' heads. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's relevant. It's admissible.
Right. Right. No, I mean, it's true. And, you know, I like, yeah, this case was that lesson for me because, we didn't end up having like a lot of real DNA evidence. You know, the scene was a scene. It was like, it was Mike and there was some casings, the projectiles in his body. That was kind of it. Like, dude drove off in the car. Like, we didn't have anything else. So it wasn't, you know, it's not like we could fingerprint a whole lot. There was not anything else really DNA wise there. It was just, that was the scene. That's what we had. And
from a DNA perspective, and again, this is one of those things people don't understand. Maybe we should get to the point where you actually did find the car here, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that like the, I'm sorry. No, you go ahead.
But my point is there had been no evidence. No one at any point said that Mike touch the car. So it's not like Mike's DNA is going to be on the car. It's not going to be there.
And, you know, that was in our head though, right? Like we wanted to find the car because what if he did touch it? What if his blood was there? Right. Like that's,
oh, sure.
that's part of the scene. So like that was a priority for sure. And, you know, we did a little digging and I ended up finding, the vehicle that Maurice was driving, but, I'll just say this real quick too. So talk about. So I get the arrest warrant at like 3:30 in the morning on Christmas Day for murder on Maurice.
Nothing says Christmas like murder. It just, you know.
Yeah, they're like 3:30 in the morning. Like, you know, I'm at Judge Odell's house, you know, 3:00 in the morning. Merry Christmas, you know, here. Can you sign this warrant for me, sir? You know, and he does. And he was always good to me. But you know, so the next day, like I didn't go home. So this thing happened at 9:30 at night. I was on night shift. So I was coming on, I can't remember if I was coming on at 4:30 or 6:30. I can't remember which part of the shift I worked at that day, probably 4:30 because it was a Tuesday. So I'd probably been up, you know, for some hours before that. And then I work all night and now I'm pushing into Christmas Day and I'm there at the office. I was the only one there still working, didn't go home, just straight work through the night, kept working. Cause I need to find the guy. And, I remember Rebecca Gregory comes in the morning, me and her were the only ones there. She was in robbery at the time. And so she comes in, I think she had like a breakfast biscuit or something at like 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. So she and I were there. And, then later that afternoon, I was still working. And, that's when Tom Cerbone opened his house to me and to Becca that Christmas and said, hey, you guys don't have anywhere to be, come eat Christmas dinner at my house. And, I just wanted to throw that in here because that was, when you're working 36 hours and you're still on it and you're still doing it and it's Christmas, everybody else is with their families. And, you know, he took us in that Christmas and that wasn't the only one he took me in on. So, just as a human being, yeah, that was just, he's just an awesome guy. So that was meaningful, but yeah, then you continue to work, right? Like you work through everybody else's with their families and you're out there grinding. And I was able to find, I didn't find the car that day. Alan actually ended up was being the one that found the car, but I found like the car, like the VIN. I identified which car it was going to be. And,
was that car registered to him or how did you figure that out?
I ended up finding a traffic citation from like several months before that Maurice was pulled over in. It was a Ford Explorer. And when I ran the license plate that he had on it from 4 months previous, the plate was no longer on the car. So he but I was able to get the VIN because that was the car. So like I had no plate, right? The plate was off. It was an old plate and I don't think it was registered anymore. I think it was like suspended or whatever. But no plate. And then just had the VIN. So, but at least we knew like the make and model that we were looking for. And so the next probably 2 weeks, was just spent just trying to find him. And we did search warrants on two or three different places. I know I went at one point, I went to an apartment he had been staying at and did a search warrant there. And we kept looking. And I'll never forget it. What date was it? It was right before New Year's. I want to say it was like the 29th of December. And we're getting ready to kind of approach that New Year's time. And we were on night shift and I was like, oh man, I found this address for Erica Johnson, who's no relation to Angela Johnson, is actually Maurice Bentley's cousin. We got her name and address on Valentine Drive as a place that Maurice had been over the last month or so, just not living there, but a place he'd been. And so I was like, man, I got to check this address. And it was like, I want to say it was like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning by then. It was just me and Alan. And I was like, man, I got to drive all the way out there. And he's like, look, you know what, man, it's just on my way home. And he was tired, man. He was like smoked, right? It was like super late at night and he just wanted to go home. And he's like, you know what, man, that's going towards, you know, my way. And he's like, I'll check it for you. I was like, you sure? He's like, yeah. And like, I wish he could tell the story because like this, him telling the story is a much better story than me telling it. But he ends up driving by and he thinks he sees the SUV, right? But he's not sure. So he drives around the back and then he has to climb a fence and like there's no tag on the truck. So he's gotta like climb a fence and then sure as shit it's the car, right? And so like once it's the car, like we can't leave it, you know. It's like we gotta do a search warrant and all this kind of stuff. So poor Alan, all he wants to do is go home and sleep, is stuck sitting on the damn car in that house for like the next 2 hours until the search warrant signed. I get the SWAT team scrambled and he's like hanging out like on a fence and just, oh man, the poor guy. But
fuck you.
No, what a partner though, man. He did it right and found the car. And so we ended up serving the search warrant with the SWAT team because we had a murder warrant for him and he just killed a dude. And so we used the SWAT team to execute that warrant and he was not there at that house, but we did get the car and we did get some other evidence out of the house. And that ended up being a bigger issue later on, and especially in the first trial. But I just mentioned it here because we get the car, we end up trying to do the forensic thing with the car. The car had flat tires. So he had, when he fled, he must have hit the curb or whatever, and he flattened his tires and rode all the way to the south side on his rims. I ended up figuring that out later on because I did his cell phone mapping. I got his phone number and was able to map his phone and saw he went right from Elliott Avenue over to Valentine Drive, and the car never left because it was all tires were a shot out. And we did try to do the blue star or the alternate light source testing for any blood and, you know, printed it and all that stuff, but we really didn't recover anything of value on the car itself. So then fast forward, about another week after that, he finally ends up getting arrested at, an apartment on Capitol Street, Presidential Plaza.
Yeah.
And, he ends up getting arrested by the U.S. Marshals Task Force and they're, he was trying to climb out a back window or something like that. And they ended up getting him. So the investigation into trying to find Maurice.
Yeah,
they all do that, man. But, so yeah, the investigation into finding Maurice Bentley was actually, pretty voluminous and almost more in depth than the actual murder investigation was. But, yeah, so Maurice didn't make any statement. He didn't want to talk. He just went right to jail. So once he was in jail, though, he did have a couple phone calls with Crystal, but he also had one with Angela Jones, where he kind of like basically just like kind of apologized for what he did. And she's like, I want you to take responsibility. And he was like, okay, you know, just real kind of.
He was agreeing that happened, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And he was basically never said he was sorry for anything that he did to Mike, but he had told Crystal also that he was sorry that he shot her mom, cause he wasn't trying to do that. So you had all these admissions too on his part, right, that, you know, that we had as part of our case. And so then, yeah, then again, with the phone records, right. Identified his phone number, did some phone mapping, which was consistent with him being at the scene when it happened. And then also on the south side to Valentine Drive after the fact. So, you know, we had some of that going for us as well. So, you know, we had I thought a pretty decent case going into the first trial.
It certainly sounds like it, doesn't it? It certainly sounds like a good case. And you talk about like all of the work that y'all did, and we're kind of running through it like it's nothing, but you know, you've done all the additional stuff, right? You've done the follow-up with the phone, you've done jail calls, you know, all the things that can be so time consuming. And
yeah, Facebook records. We got Facebook records and stuff too.
Right. So you've got all this corroboration for these eyewitnesses and you're feeling pretty good. This case got assigned, and I think it was because there were children present in the house and it was a little unclear if there was a child cruelty or not. Case got assigned in our office to Emily Buhala.
I'll tell you why that happened.
Okay.
That happened because he was a registered sex offender.
Right.
He was a registered sex offender. And this was the other little piece that, you know, a jury can't hear. So he's a registered sex offender and he's on the registry because he was convicted of raping his sister. So he had convictions for rape and incest. So that's the kind of guy he was. But again, that's something the jury never hears.
What they did get to hear is that he's a convicted felon and the convictions were for rape and incest. What they didn't get to hear was he raped his sister.
The last trial they did. Yes. I want to say the first couple, they didn't get to, they just heard that he was a convicted felon, I'm pretty sure.
And that's possible. I don't know. I was not present for the first two, just the one where they got a conviction.
Yeah. That was in the last trial, but that was not in the first two. And actually it was a third mistrial at one point because, and this was when Emily still had it. The first one was like a true mistrial after the whole jury trial we went through and there was a hung jury. And then the second one was the first retrial after that. And there was some kind of scheduling issue with Dr. Downs. And also I think with me too at one point, but mainly it was with Downs because we could work around my schedule thing because it wasn't the whole week. It was like 1 or 2 days or something like that. And Judge Walmsley got really pissed off about it for whatever reason and was just like mistrial, just like declared a mistrial. So that was the second one. The third one, it was me and Jenny. And then the fourth one was actually me and you. So we had gone to
prep this
three separate times
before. But there was a whole lot of drama in that first trial. And so, you know, I'm sure that you bring this case and it's in good shape and you bring it to Emily and she's like, great. Because Emily at that time had a lot of trials. I mean, the child cases, it just seems like it's back to back to back a lot in Chatham. And so I think what happened was like, she sent out subpoenas and was like, I'll be ready, you know, sure, you know, that kind of thing. And I got the impression that there were maybe some strategic decisions that weren't made that if you have more time, you might've made.
Well, no, I think that this is one of the ones I legit, like I go back on and I'm like, I don't know what any of us could have done differently. I thought Emily did a great job in that first trial. I thought she did a fantastic job actually. And it was just one of those things where, it came out, Crystal's 380 came out in her testimony. And I think that's what it was. Okay. Yeah. Now I'm remembering it. So in the first trial, I think at one point we had asked Crystal, do you have any firearms? And she said, yeah, I bought one a while ago or whatever. And it wasn't, I didn't probe it any more than that in the interview. So she's on the stand in the first trial and Rodman was like, isn't it true you had a gun at some point or you bought a gun or something? And she's like, yeah, I had a 380. And then it was like, oh shit. So well, we didn't know. Yeah. Nobody knew that in the first one. So, you know, I thought Emily did a good job with it. As far as that goes, but, and nobody could have predicted that's what she would have said. Right. But once she said it, then that was kind of like a thing. And, John Rodman, I think, did a good job of, kind of hanging on that and making that part of his defense, along with, playing up the whole SWAT team at Erica Johnson's house, because Erica Johnson had kids and in the house and this kind of stuff. And this was right on the heels of Ferguson, Missouri, like literally like within, I think, a month or two. And so everybody's like up in fire about police. And he really did a good job playing to the 380 and then to the SWAT team and us kicking the door. And he made it sound like we were just like, you know, the police are just a bunch of, you know, baby killers and, you know, this type of stuff. And yeah, so his argument was that Crystal was the shooter and the police are just a bunch of buffoons that are going to kick the door in on a bunch of kids. And it worked for him, at least to a hung jury. So they couldn't decide. And I want to say a split was like 6-6 or 7-5. It was like nowhere close on one side or the other. It was like, you know, really deadlocked. And so,
well, I want to talk about that just a little bit, because I've tried cases with John Rodman and obviously I'm familiar with his approach to trial and things like that. I feel like there's an element with him, you know, if he has an opening to blame it on the police in some way, or blame any part of the, you know, like any flaw in the investigation, any, you know, brutality or rush to judgment. He likes to use that term a lot. You know, confirmation bias, those kinds of things. Those terms come up a lot. And there is a segment of the defense bar that they're always going to bring those kinds of things up. So how was that a part of that trial?
He did say, you know, the rush to judgment, because it was like, you know, the arrest warrant was signed within 6 hours, basically the 911 call. And so he called that a rush to judgment. And, you know, I sit there and I think about it and it's like, you can't win on that. Like you can't, as a police officer, you can't win. So the flip side of it is, what if I didn't take the arrest warrant out and he kills somebody else, or he knows he's on the run, so he hurts somebody else, or another cop doesn't know that he's wanted for murder. And then that cop stops him and gets shot by him because he thinks he's wanted. And, you know, there's just so many things that, like, you're duty bound at that point as an investigator to swear that arrest warrant, because you've got more than abundant probable cause. It's not like thin, right? You're not stretching it. It's just, that's your obligation. And then you just have to know you're going to turn around in a trial and freaking, they're going to tell you that you just rush to judgment on it. And, you know, I that's just going to be, and I think Emily did a decent job at talking about that, but ultimately, as an investigator, you're not gonna be able to say shit about that. Like, that's going to be on the prosecutor to defend against that. Right. Like that's going to be on you to either redirect me and say, you know, did you rush to judgment? You know, what's the standard for an arrest warrant? And, you know, walk the jury through right. It that way, or you argue it in your closing, right?
Right. I mean, and I probably would, you know, more argue it in closing. It's like, all right, well, let's just say that's true. Look at all of this corroboration. This is not invented. You know, this cell tower information, all of these things, you didn't invent that. The calls where he admits it, you invented that? I mean, come on, no. No,
yeah.
Absolutely not. And, you know, this is all on him. This is not a rush. This was methodical. This was well thought out and was well applied. Every skill that you had was used in this case. You did not overlook and fail to check a box. So that's not what happened here.
Yeah. And like, you know, you can't do it from the stand as an investigator, because then you just look defensive and, you know, whatever. You can just say, no, that's not true. I didn't do that.
Right. As an advocate, as a prosecutor. And the thing is, you know, I think this is one of those things too, we get accused of, and I've been accused of it by, I don't know how many people, including I'm sure John Rodman, of being an advocate for a side. I'm an advocate for the truth, right? For the evidence. And this is what the evidence shows. Now, of course, you know, you can play games with it. And that is what the defense wants to do more often than not. But, you know, if there's a flaw, it's kind of like when we're talking about like how many points there are on a fingerprint, right? Like, oh, you only used, you know, 3 or 7 or 10 or whatever. It's like, well, I can keep going. Let's just keep going. I can prove this 100 different ways. Let's keep going. And that's what you do. I mean, that's what, you know, a good investigator does. It's like, okay, you want to come after me for getting an arrest warrant early, but I didn't just get an arrest warrant and sit down and say, I'm done.
Right.
That's not what happened. And so I've had cases where officers did that, and it is very hard to defend that. It is very hard to defend that. Unless, you know, your victims or eyewitnesses are absolutely freaking amazing. So I don't know how to tell people that are involved in this line of work enough that you're never going to feel like you have done absolutely everything, right? I don't know that you're ever going to feel like you've done absolutely everything in your power. But you need to shut down every argument you can think of. And you don't know what, a lot of times you don't know what those arguments are until you've been to court on something and had your ass kicked, right?
Yeah. Or like, you know, for instance, like a particular case, like you don't know what's going to be important. You don't know what that detail is going to be until you're there in it, right? In that specific trial. And it could be a different in each trial, even with the same case, right? Like some of the same issues came up with this one, but there were also different ones, and it just depends. And that's why, like, you and I talk about this a little bit, off this podcast, but it's like, it's important to, I think, have both the prosecutor and the investigator together in the courtroom during the trial, because there's a lot of the investigation that, the investigator knows because they lived it. No matter, you know, and that's not a dig on the prosecutor, right? Like you can, like you're one of the best and you read everything and you watch everything. And to be honest with you, like you're probably the only one that I know that actually does all that. I think other people do it, but they take shortcuts, right? They might not watch all the body camera. They might just read the reports and shit, I'm guilty of it too, honestly. Like on some of my cases in Savannah, I didn't watch all the body camera on every case. Like I didn't.
I would watch most of it, or the ones I felt you can engage, like one, if your body cam is, I'm standing at the tape line for 14 hours, you know, I'm not watching that one all the way through, but you know, I'm going to watch people talking to people and that kind of stuff.
Right. Right. And like, you know, even with you doing all that, you know, you may not absorb all of it in the same way. And so, yeah, like those little detail things, you know, how many times have you and I been in a trial together? And it's like, you're like, hey, what else? Or is there anything I'm missing? And it's like,
shit. Yeah.
Or ask this, or like, you know, he said this, but like, I know this is the evidence and this is contrary to what they're saying, or this is an important thing they said and they didn't say it on the stand. And so ask them about it. Right. Like there's just, it just always comes up. I think every trial that I've sat in on, something like that's always come up, no matter what case, right, or what prosecutor I was working with, it always came up.
Right. And Sheely, you know, we are some going to talk about, I remember sitting in trial with y'all and like, right, like the day before closings being like, this is the answer. Like, you know, looking at a picture and being like, oh, that explains, there's no way this was any other way. Right. Because where the seat was in that case, but you know, there's stuff that there's always something that's going to support it too. Right. That you didn't think about, I didn't think about it, but it's there. It's all there, right? You've got the pictures, you've got the stuff. But, you know, truly, that is invaluable to have like other people that you can bounce that off of, because you know, when you're isolated, it's kind of like divide and conquer, right? You know, we aren't able to pull together as a team. And that I think is, and I understand that's a rule where you are now, that people aren't allowed to sit at council tables after they testify or whatever. And I find that inconsistent with federal rules, with Georgia rules, with, you know, I just don't think that that is logical. So I'm really find that disturbing for you. And I also know what a value you are. It's like having another lawyer, or even better, because you're the investigator who really knows your case. Because you sometimes, yeah. I have, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, I could get Twin sitting there and he's snoring, having him at council table. <You know?
laughs> Well, that's like the hard part for me too, is like, you know, I take a lot of pride in the work, and, you know, I invest myself into the people and the families, like, you know, and so I know I can help, and not being there, not being able to be there, I feel like I feel helpless, and that sucks. And, you know, for somebody like, you know, like Marshall Polite, I mean, just one of the nicest men I've ever met. And for this poor guy to have to go through 3 mistrials before, you know, finally there being a conviction on a case that's like, you know, you got 3 people telling you this is what happened. Like, what's the fucking question here? You know, like, it's just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, that is something you have to explain to the victims. I mean, you have to explain it to Crystal and Angela Johnson and Kim. We're going to have to come back and do this again. Because, you know, at some point, people are just so worn emotionally, having to go through it again and again and again.
Yeah.
That, you know, just getting up for, even for you, and I'm sure, like, you know, because you and Jenny did this more than once, and, you know, Emily had to get ready for it at least twice. It's exhausting, you know, to get up and be like, have the adrenaline going for like the next one that is the same facts, right? You know, how is this going to be fresh for you? Where's the challenge? Because again, and I think there's an element of that too for a jury. Like, they want to feel like they're figuring it out with you, like almost like they want to feel smart. And so you have to like be able to, you know, answer their questions and anticipate what those might be.
And it was like, maybe I'm jumping ahead of here too, but it was like, this was a case that I felt like just kept on going. even after the final jury conviction, the 4th trial, we got a conviction, and it was maybe a year later, we end up recovering Crystal Frazier's Davis 380 pistol, because Crystal's Davis 380 pistol was not the murder weapon. And we ended up proving that in our trial just through the rifling pattern and Kevin Rittman being able to talk about that. But it fucking surfaced and we recovered it. And like, sure as shit, I had to fucking sign evidence out from the clerk's office and take it to the GBI and have them compare it, because, right, if that's right, potentially exculpatory, and the dude's in prison now on a life sentence. And so like, you got to do that. So it was just like, God, is this case ever going to be done? And like, it felt like it never was. I mean, I think that was what year was it finally that Crystal's gun came back and they excluded it? It was like in 2018 or 2019, dude. It was like 6 years.
2019 after. Was the Supreme Court opinion. So, cause I did the appeal. So yeah, 2019, that sounds right. Cause it was while the motion for a new trial was pending, if I remember right.
Yeah. So it was like, you know, 5 or 6 years afterwards that we're still going, yeah. You know, like,
geez, yeah, but in case anyone's wondering, that did not, it was excluded as being the murder.
Yeah, it was not, we knew it wasn't going to be, but we still had to get it done. Right. You still have to do it. And we did it, and it was not the gun. No, it was not the murder weapon. The murder weapon actually, I think, got recovered too a little while later. And it was, interestingly, we talked about Erica Johnson's kids. And at the time, she had a 15-year-old boy, and I don't remember his name, so I'm not going to guess, but it was recovered in an incident related to him. So, wow. What I then thought and kind of deduced or pieced together was he probably gave it to that 15-year-old boy after the murder. And the boy thought it was probably cool to have a gun, not knowing it had a murder on it, or maybe he did, I don't know. But yeah, it was eventually recovered. It was kind of a moot point, I think, by then, but it was associated to that kid.
Wow, that's sad. That is sad. I don't know that I've known that. I probably did. You probably told me. I probably got the whole thing. But yeah, this case went on and on and on. So, you know, even in that first trial, and I remember talking, because Kevin Rittman was my witness in the last one, talking to Kevin about it. In the very first trial, they're asking him, well, you know, could this have been, you know, Davis 380 or you know, some other 380 fired this, you don't know exactly what kind, just all of the normal challenges. And he was unprepared for that because no one had any idea that Crystal was ever going to say what she said.
Right.
And so he was unable to, like, just on the stand have total recall of the rifling pattern of a Davis versus a Branko Jennings versus, you know, yeah, any of them. So yeah, by the time I got involved, he had gone back and, you know, done additional work. You, I think, had done some additional work as well, as far as trying to run things down.
Yeah, we ended up getting the purchasing paperwork from the ATF from where she purchased the gun. And so we were able to get the serial number and all that stuff from it. So yeah, we had done a bunch of legwork on the gun itself.
Right. And I think between, and I want to save some stuff for Jenny, because Jenny is going to come on. Yay. I'm so excited. And I want to talk to her about trying these cases. I think that she came into it, and it's something that I think she is very gifted at, is dealing with victims and victims' families, and, you know, just keeping them on track to, you know, come in and do what needs to be done. And especially when you've got to do it again and again and again, it's really hard.
Yeah, you know, this case was it was kind of special to me in a lot of ways. And I don't know that I even ever told you this story, but I know, like, one of the last times we were talking about how I had applied to law school, and I don't know if we ever got to the point where I didn't go to law school, where I stayed. So a big part of that was Jack Lumpkin. He moved me back to homicide, and that was a big part of it. But one of the bigger parts of it that hit me even before I knew I was going to be going back to homicide, that made it, that really pulled at my heart to stay in Savannah, was, remember I was telling you about in the Manigo case, like, I worked all those overtime patrol shifts. Well, one shift I was over in Central working overtime in a uniform. And, it was one of those nights where I had done a follow-up interview or two on that Manigo case. And I ended up backing up a guy on a traffic stop. And it was over on a, like, 33rd and, like, Live Oak, I think. So it was there around that area right there. And, I was just backing the guy up, right? I was just, he was doing his traffic stop, and I was just kind of security, keeping eyes out. And, you know, like, I hadn't seen her since probably the first trial. And I don't think we'd gone to the second or third one yet. And there's Crystal. She's just walking down the street. And I said, "Hey, Crystal," you know, and she said, "Oh, hey." And, you know, she gave me a hug and just talked to her for a little bit. Said, you know, "Hey, how are you doing? You know, and how things going? How's your mom?" And it was just like, I thought to myself, where else could I go and like get this, you know, like a city like Savannah is, like, big, but it's small, right? Like, and that wasn't, like, the only interaction I had like that, but it was like, it was probably at one of the most meaningful and impactful times in my life, where I was on that cusp of, like, should I stay or leave? And in my heart, I was like, I need to stay here, you know? And then things worked out for me to get back to homicide, where I feel like I belonged. And, but it was just one of those kind of moments. And it was all related to like this case and sort of what I went through with this case and some of the people. And, it was just kind of like an interesting periphery of this case, and Michael Polite and his dad, and just, I don't know, the intricate web of our connections and relationships with people as we do this job and try to help people in their times of need and things like that. And of all people, right? I never would have pegged, like, you know, Crystal Frazier as the one that had that impact on me and getting me to stay, you know, but that was part of it.
Yeah. That is fascinating. And you saw her again even after the last trial. I remember we talked about that too.
Yeah, I had seen her. I kind of had tended to run into Crystal. You know, the last couple of years I was there, I didn't see Crystal, but after the last trial, I remember I had seen her, and I forget where now, but I'd seen her a few times outside of, you know, like the job, just kind of running into her different places. But yeah, it was interesting. And just the way that happens, I don't know.
Well, you're right. And you know, I guarantee you, if you were to like wander down 33rd and Live Oak, you could have Sharon Robbins run up on you. you know, yeah. Give you a big hug too. She'd have you back in a heartbeat. We all would, seriously. Yeah. But I know that you are where you need to be too. And that's as hard as that is to admit. I get it, but I miss you, and I miss, you know, like the way we were all working together at the time. So I am excited to be, you know, putting the pieces together for covering the rest of the trials of this case, because I felt like there were a lot of interesting elements and things that went wrong and, you know, lessons to be learned even in the retrials. And I think that that's going to be something that might be helpful for some people to hear, like, you know, even as good as you are and as good as this case was, it still kept getting, you know, hammered at. So yeah, I think this is going to be like a good thing, and I'm excited to have Jenny on too, and fingers crossed maybe we'll get Kevin. We can
talk, yeah, about, you know, just the takeaway is that the cases that you think are the best cases are going to be the hardest ones. They're always going to be the hardest ones, like the ones that you're like, oh, this case is a great case, like this should be an easier decision for the jury to make. They're always the hardest cases. They're like slugfest, man. Like, so just if you have you think you got a good case, that's going to be your hardest case to win in a trial. I guarantee you it.
If it looks too good to be true, it's too good to be true.
yeah, and just, you know, no case is ever too good. And that's what I've experienced. It's like, you know, I mean, I've had some of my toughest cases. We've talked about them on this podcast, Lawrence Bryan's case, the Ron Robbins's case. Like, those were cases going into trial, I was like, man, I can see us losing, you know, like I, you know, not that they weren't good cases, but it was like, you don't have three eyewitnesses identifying them right off the rip, all cooperating, showing the court every time, right? Like, you were arresting people in those cases just to testify. Like, and it's so, you know, some of it just is what it is. But I mean, yeah, it's like, those, don't get me wrong, right? Like the Ron Robbins' trial and then Lawrence Bryan's trial, those were also their own battles, especially Lawrence Bryan's trial. But you know, this was like, I never would have thought it would have been this hard on this case.
Yeah. I mean, this definitely, Maurice Bentley is where he needs to be. Would not be there without you. But there is no explaining all the things that went awry in the trials of this case. So I'm looking forward to covering the rest of this with you. I'm so grateful that you took time in the middle of your week to actually come on again. And I really want to get you and Jenny together on the podcast, because we haven't been able to do that, and that's going to be fun. So I'm looking forward to it, and we'll be talking to you really soon, okay?
That sounds great, Christy. Thanks. Cool.
Thanks.
It's It's easy to write off the murder of Michael Polite as typical, quote unquote, baby's mama drama, but nothing about this family tragedy that stole Michael from his children on Christmas Eve was straightforward. The need for multiple retrials in this case shows how the simple truth can be obscured by the defense, leaving jurors confused and wanting more and more. I look forward to having Assistant District Attorney Jenny Parker on to talk about the complexity of retrials and the strength it takes to keep fighting. Tune in.